calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
945 days, 12 hours, 54 minutes, 59 seconds until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office, assuming that there's no impeachment attempt. May not be a safe assumption. Welcome to our program, my friends. Happy Monday to you. Our quote for the day, America will never be destroyed from the outside. If we falter and lose our freedoms, it will be because we destroyed ourselves. Abraham Lincoln. Coming up on today's program, who is Dick DeVos? Managing editor of Political Affairs magazine Joel Wendland will tell us all we need to know about Dick DeVos. Also, Alec DeBrow, media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, is joining us on union busting campaigns. Right now, Alex Epstein is with us. He's a fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, specializing in business, government, and business and government regulation. AYNRAND.org, the website. Ayn Rand, of course, the author of Atlas Shrugged and other textbooks, other novels, and also nonfiction screeds that became the basis of objectivism, which then has morphed over time, although Alex and the Ayn Rand Institute are still in the original pure form, but has morphed into various variations, including the libertarians, the Cato Institute, and the extreme right wing of the Republican Party. Alex, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Alex, you have been writing recently about net neutrality versus internet freedom, and I find it really interesting that the big corporations that own the giant pipes that carry most of the internet data around the United States are now sponsoring ads in which they say, you don't want the government controlling your internet, do you? The fact of the matter is, Alex, right now the government is protecting the neutrality of the internet, and you think that's a bad idea?
Well, I don't think there is any neutrality on the internet, and I think that's a good thing. I mean, all that the net neutrality issue is about is, should companies who own networks be free to divide bandwidth between standard internet data and then premium internet data, in the same way that cable companies divide their bandwidth between digital television bandwidth and internet bandwidth. And there's no reason at all why they should be prohibited from doing so. And the net neutrality people say they shouldn't be able to offer these premium services. And I
think first of all, we're mixing apples and oranges. The cable companies separate out the premium services based on what the customer is willing to pay for. The net neutrality, the anti-net neutrality folks, the net privatization folks, are not arguing that I as a customer should pay extra, or shouldn't have to pay extra if I want higher speed internet service. It's not about that. It's not about having access to premium channels on the internet. What it's about is the speed with which data passes over the internet. What these companies right now that have the pipes through which all this data is flowing, it's like the giant water mains through which all the water flows, they have figured out that they have these Cisco switches and other manufacturers as well that can analyze every single bit of data that goes through, in fact, observe them as it passes through, and decide whether to speed up or slow down that data, thus artificially creating high-speed and low-speed pathways through the internet. And then they can come to people who want to have their data on the internet, say the New York Times or say Common Dreams, and say, pay us and your data goes fast, or don't pay us and your data goes slow. That sounds to me like racketeering.
No, it's offering a service. And first of all, the second half of that is not true. It's not your data goes slow. It's a question of, do you guarantee a certain quality of service, especially for streaming applications like video? It's really important that every little packet of data get delivered on time. And so what they're offering is, they're saying, we are going to apportion a certain amount of our bandwidth for this kind of premium services so that you can sell customers for TV over the internet that's high quality and that can be real time. So I can watch a soccer game and it can be in perfect quality and I can get it right now, as opposed to if all of the data is treated equally, then maybe my soccer game will get slowed down by someone else's internet search.
No,
when
it's
that
not
internet
that
search isn't
it's not
time-sensitive.
That they're going to apportion a certain amount of that bandwidth for that. It's that they're going to apportion a certain amount of that bandwidth for that and charge for it. They're already apportioning a certain amount of bandwidth for that.
Of course they should charge for it. I mean, they should make as much money off their networks as they can. They spend billions and billions of dollars. These are very risky investments. As you you can see by the valuations of these companies making these ventures, it's not at all clear that it'll be worthwhile. A lot of people have lost billions and billions of dollars building broadband infrastructure. They should absolutely figure out the way to use the bandwidth in the way that will be most profitable, i.e. in the way that people will value it most and must be willing to pay the most money for it.
But most of that data, most of that bandwidth, most of those cables, Alex Epstein, are going over public rights of way. These are, and the internet is the last bastion of absolute freedom. Nobody owns the internet. You can own the pipes that that some of the internet goes through, although you can't limit all of them. So you'd have to have what, an exemption from the antitrust rules, presumably, because you know I can route data from where are you located, Alex?
I'm located in Irvine, California.
Okay, so I'm in Portland, Oregon. So I can route data. You know, between you and me, there are ways that you can figure out how the data is bouncing. We could route it through a half a dozen different systems right now, and it would go through a half a dozen different companies. And so presumably these companies are going to get together and collude to determine how fast the data is going to go.
What do you mean collude? How fast the data goes depends on how fast they built the network. I mean, when I started using the internet, I had a 2400 baud modem. Now it goes a lot faster, and it's because they've been free to create networks and to make a profit off them. And what I want is for them to continue to be free so that they can offer, instead of just 1 megabit a second, 100 megabits a second or a gigabit a second.
But
the only way that's
right
going to happen is if they're free to make a profit.
But they're doing that right now. People are paying based on the amount of data that they have coming out of the web, and they're paying based on the amount of data they have going into the web. But what these guys want to do is they want to go now and they want to say, okay, and the stuff as it's flowing through our pipes, we get to slow down or speed up individual pieces of that data and charge for that. And that it just seems wrong. Then we no longer have the internet that we all own. Now we have privatized the internet.
Yeah, but it's nonsense that we all own it. You get access to the internet based on what you earn.
The internet was created by the government. It was created by us collectively.
No, it was not created by us collectively. It only became a
It was created by DARPA.
No, okay.
They're Department of Defense.
No, the very original thing that was useless to 99.999% of us was created by DARPA, which they're still bragging about. But they, in terms of the internet being a viable commercial thing that you and I have access to and that we can communicate with everyone in the world over, that is almost exclusively a commercial business achievement. And the only way that that's going to continue is if they're left free. And they have there's no difference in the world between Microsoft being able to pay for a 1 gigabyte per second internet connection versus me being able to only pay for 1 megabit per second, and then Microsoft's competitors being free to say, we want higher priority for our data so it gets guaranteed delivered at a certain rate. Whereas
there's a world of difference, Alex, because the cost right now of being able to deliver data into the web at a fairly high speed is quite low. My pages load pretty much just as fast as Microsoft's do right now, and I'm not paying $1 million a month like Microsoft is for data. That has to do with the volume of data that's being pumped through. And I think it's entirely appropriate that I be charged based on the amount of stuff I'm pouring into the river, right? And that at home I am charged, you know, based on do I want dial-up for $9 a month or do I want high-speed DSL or cable access for $30 a month? That all makes sense to me. But for AT&T or Verizon, with whom I have, you know, I'm not even doing business. They're not the companies that are hosting my website, and they're not the companies that are delivering my data to me. For one of them to come to me and say, hey, listen, you want your page to load as fast as the New York Times loads? $100,000 a year, Charlie. Otherwise, it's going to take 3 seconds for your page to load. You'll be in the slow lane.
Yeah,
that's
no,
extortion.
Yeah, but it's offering you a service, and it's nonsense that somehow your page is going to start loading very slowly. What customer in the world is going to pay for your page taking 30 seconds to load?
What'll happen is it's going to ghettoize the internet, just like it has cable. You're going to have the high speed, fast, slick sites that are paying for to be high speed and fast, and then you know if you go looking for stuff and you know googling around looking for information or trying to get onto the Ayn Rand site, unless you guys you know, I don't think you guys are, you know, super wealthy unless you can come up with the money to pay for it. Your pages are going to be loading slow too.
They'll load more. It's an issue of they'll load more slowly, and that's absolutely appropriate. If a company wants to have its pay, everyone has to earn what should earn what they get in a free market.
But this is a regulated market. This is a regulated monopoly. It's not a free market.
Well, it's pretty close to free, and you're talking about public rights of way, and there are complicated issues, and I don't fully agree with the system as it's set up, but these are networks that pay to build them, and they're numerous competing networks.
Alex, stick around. Let's wrap this thing up, and if any of our listeners want to get in on this conversation, our phone number 1-866-440-8466. We'll take another 15 minutes here with Alex Epstein of the Ayn Rand Institute. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Exposing the con in conservative. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. We're talking with Alex Epstein of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. And just a quick note to our board op. I just put Alex on the other side of the board so we can take callers here as well. So you may have to repot him up. Alex, are you still there?
I am.
Great. Okay. Here's Jenna in Seattle, Washington. Jenna, you're live with Alex. What's up?
I was just speaking with you, Tom. As my memory serves me, the government invented the Internet. And so I'm wondering why the taxpayer paid for invention should be used for profit off of corporations who are really just administrators. And a couple months ago, when this debate came up in the international community of who should be, you know, looking after administering the Internet, we told the international community to, you know, take off because this is an American thing.
We didn't want the UN administering it because they would administer it as a commons, and we were feeling very proprietary about it. And so we said, you know, leave it with the United States to control the Internet, and we'll make sure that it's always a neutral thing.
Absolutely.
And now we're backing away from that, Alex.
Okay. Well, there are at least two issues here. It's just first to comment on the UN quickly. I mean, the UN is a completely anti-freedom organization. Any organization that invites countries like Iran and was founded with the Soviet Union as a veto-having member has no business dealing with anything having to do with freedom. So that is a contemptible organization.
The United Nations was created
as a
device to maintain world peace, and I think they did a fairly good job during the Cold War. But debating the relative merits or demerits of the UN is I don't think what we're here to talk about. Alex.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So and the other thing is, I believe the caller referred to these companies like AT&T and Verizon as being more or less administrative and that the government created and is taxpayer-funded. I mean, that is just not true. It's, as you've mentioned before, DARPA and the Pentagon were involved with the creation of the original network that later became expanded by about a billion times and became the Internet. But as far as the Internet as a thing that interconnects all of us, that is a commercial achievement. And these companies that provide the backbone of the Internet do incredible work and take huge, huge risks, which many people have lost billions of dollars to.
And they make huge, huge profits, and many corporations have made hundreds of billions of dollars in profits.
No, but they certainly deserve the profits when they get them.
But what does that have to do with whether or not, you know, again, I'm agreeing with you. I'll give you that the companies that are carrying the data should be able to charge based on the volume of data going through them.
Why shouldn't they be able to charge for premium services that customers like me want to buy?
It's the equivalent of somebody running a toll road and saying, okay, we're going to run this toll road, but if you have a red car, you have to drive over there in the slow lane. If you have a blue car, you can go over here in the fast lane.
Well, it's like saying if you want to pay a dollar more, you can go in the fast lane, and that sounds great to me.
With a toll road, yeah. Okay, well, see, that's the problem with toll roads. I mean, this is why I think that all of us, I think there's this collective mentality in the United States and in the world that the Internet is essentially a common. It has become part of the commons, and people want to keep it that way. Joe in Atlantic Island, New Jersey, you're live with Alex Epstein.
This is me, okay. Listen, the notion of the Internet as we know it being a commercial achievement is absurd. The phone company spent untold billions trying to develop something called OSI, Open System Interconnection, in the 1980s. It was the biggest failure of the telecommunications industry ever. The Internet as we know it is an entirely non-commercial achievement. It came from the TCP/IP protocol. It came from the World Wide Web, which was developed by Tim Berners-Lee while working at CERN. And it came from the Mosaic browser, which was developed at the National Supercomputer, NCSA, another public institution. So it's just an absurd notion.
Good points.
I disagree that that's a good point. So all of the things, first of all, you mentioned Sun, which is a private company.
No, I didn't mention Sun. I talked about OSI, Open Systems Interconnection, a huge failure of the phone company.
Of course, there are lots of failures in the market.
No, international failure. They just could not do it.
Okay.
They could not do it.
I grasp that OSI is a failure, but still, if you look at Amazon.com, Google, the content providers that have made the Internet so prominent, and then the network providers, there have been huge, huge innovations in broadband technology and the way that they process packets and optical switches and optical routers. All of these
and
things
they should
are
be able to use that to squeeze even more profit out of us.
They should be. It's not squeezing profit. They sell. They create a value. They should be able to charge.
But they have a monopoly on this product. I can't bury a cable across the United States to carry internet data without. You know, I can't do it. I can't do it. They are using our public rights of way to carry this data.
Well, but they. It's still their property. They've secured a property.
No, it's our property that they happen to be using.
I don't own Verizon.
I beg your pardon?
I don't own Verizon, and neither do you. I didn't do anything to create it. The fact that they have a property.
No,
but
Verizon doesn't own the rights of way on which their cables are operating. They have some obligation to the public good if they're going to use our rights of way.
Yeah, well, they do own the cables, and they created them, and they should be able to process.
Alex Epstein, Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org. Alex, good talking with you today.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, for all things Macintosh. Give them a call and tell them we said hi. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the true people's radio, our number 1-866-440-8466. We've been talking with Alex Epstein of the Ayn Rand Institute. Always interesting to hear the perspective, the thinking behind the thinking of these folks. And the bottom line, I mean, when you get right down to it, and I don't think Alex would argue with me on this, I try not to pick on people when they're not here to defend themselves, but I'm fairly confident that I'm putting this forward as a way that actually reflects the point of view, at least of Ayn Rand, the Ayn Rand Institute, and that is that if a corporation can figure out a way to make more money off a product or service that they have, they not only have every right to, they have every obligation to. And if we don't like it, tough luck. And, you know, my argument on the flip side of that is that there are some things that are natural monopolies. And natural monopolies should be tightly regulated by the government, in my opinion, so that they operate. Yes, people can make a profit on them, and they operate to the public benefit. We do this with public power. We do it with water systems. We do it with sewage systems. And we do it with telephone systems. And I believe that we should be doing it with the Internet as well. Sean in Rapids, Wisconsin. Rapids, Wisconsin. Hey, Sean, what's up?
I had a disagreement with you guys saying that that it's all on public right of way and that that they don't pay anything for the right of way usage.
I didn't say they don't pay for the right-of-way usage, but I said that. But I did say that the most of the lines that carry internet data are coming are via public rights-of-way. They're under our streets and on our telephone poles and things.
Yeah, but we definitely pay for those. I don't do it anymore, but I built most of the backbone fiber. Request level 3, AT&T. Most recent was AT&T. And this is the backbone, the mainline system, not the locals. But whenever we did not currently own the right-of-way, we paid for that right-of-way or pay on a yearly basis for that right-of-way usage. Sometimes right. On the use on how much. a lot of those right-of-way agreements.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, the cities and the states held us over a barrel towards the end. And when I say towards the end, our business fell down the crapper. There were years where you could get work anywhere in the country building fiber. We haven't built a new backbone line since 9/11 fell.
Yeah, that's in large part because the dot-com bubble ended and everybody was overbuilding. I mean, that was the big problem MCI had.
The investor confidence just went right out the window, and it shut us all down. It put thousands and thousands of us out of work.
Right.
And, you know, I work in the oil industry now. I went from fiber optics to oil because there was nothing else.
Because that's where the money was, yeah.
And,
Sean, I got to move along. Thanks for the call. Very informative. I appreciate you calling in.
Thank you.
Mark in Livermore, California. Hey, Mark.
Hi, Tom. I was hoping to talk to Alex when he was on, but one thing that Alex is completely ignoring and a lot of the free market ideologues are ignoring is that what the telcos are trying to do is they're trying to double dip.
They're charging right now for bandwidth.
But now
they want to charge for speed.
Well, what's happening is that the provider is already paying their costs for delivering their content.
Right.
The customer is already paying what they're paying to access that content.
Right.
The telcos do not want to make it look like they're raising prices on their customers. So they're looking for innovative ways to get more money out of the entire industry. So instead of raising the monthly fee on the customer, they are going to try to charge the content provider to deliver that content to their customer.
Right, and thus increase profits.
Right. I mean, if you look at it, a lot of people like now, they look up on their internet bill or mm-hmm. their internet ISP bill, they're going to see a charge for a regulatory recovery fee. That's not a real regulatory recovery fee. That's a fee that the ISPs charge for the cost of doing business.
The internet service providers.
Yes.
Yeah. Interesting.
And it's an illegal fee, but the FCC isn't doing anything about it.
Okay. Mark, thank you very much.
It's a way for them to raise the rates without raising the rates.
Yeah, this has been my point, that what we have here are functional monopolies. And in something that I think is thought of by many people as the commons, or at least some dimension of it being part of the commons, and they're just trying to figure out a way to make it less common, less fair, and net neutrality. You know, the opponents of net neutrality are basically opposed to neutrality because we can make some more money on this thing. We can push a little farther. Got to move along. Mark, thanks for the call. KJ in Camas, Washington. Hey, KJ.
Hi. Hey, you know, Tom, I'm inclined to agree with the Ayn Rand Institute.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's just turn it all over to the free market if we can make one fundamental assumption. These corporations, once they have this power, will they act in the public interest? Now, how many times in the last 25 years have they done that?
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, if we look back, I mean, you know, it's, for example, in 2004, North Carolina ISP named Madison River, they blocked their DSL customers from using any rival web-based phone system. In 2005, Canada's telephone giant TELUS blocked customers from visiting a website sympathetic to the telecommunications workers union during a labor dispute. Shaw, major Canadian cable, internet, and telephone service provider, intentionally downgrades the quality and reliability of competing internet phone services. In April, AOL Time Warner blocked all emails that mentioned DearAOL.com, which is an anti-AOL site. I mean, they're already out there messing with our data. This would just make it entirely legal. Next, how to frame your points when debating conservatives at the water cooler, 46 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Louie in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Louie, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I just took you off a speaker. I'm a Bell South employee, soon to be AT&T, I hope. And
uh-huh.
Number one, we're unionized. Never forget that. Most of the baby bells are unionized. We get good pay and benefits, so any cost up there is, you know, I'm a lefty union vice president, so these cheaper fly-by-night companies that can lower costs, they're also paying nothing to their employees and not getting medical benefits. So that's a sidebar. Okay. The main thing is the cable companies, being Time Warner, Bright House here in Orlando, it's the same company, Cox Cable, they are actually the only real competition we have, and they're driving us hard. When they lower their price, we got to follow suit. So no matter what legislation goes through that relates to the Ma Bells, which is the Bell South, SBC, basically it'll just be AT&T, Quest, and Verizon by October, November.
No, I think you're missing something, Louis. This is what they're talking about is not at the level of the customer or even at the level of the local node, and they're not talking about at the level of the consumer, you know, the person like you or me who has a pays $30 a month for DSL or $32 a month for cable or whatever it may be. They're not talking about that competition, and they're not talking about, you know, like TomHartman.com. I pay a local internet service provider or whatever they call it, you know, web hosting company to host the website. They're not talking about that. What they're saying is that that because all this data going through these giant pipes that cross the country is passing through switches where those switches have the ability to analyze that data and determine what site it originated from.
Right.
That if your site pays them a fee, they will speed you up, and if you don't pay them a fee, they will slow you down. So the customer discovers is that a website that doesn't pay the fee, it takes 2 or 3 seconds to load, whereas, say, the New York Times pays the fee, their web page loads instantly. And what you're going to create is basically a fast, slick Internet and a slow, ghettoized Internet. And the fast, slick is going to be the people with the big bucks.
But the other flip side, again, is if Bright House or, you know, Time Warner, Cox Cable, they don't sign on that plan, then again, they're going to say, well, hey, guys, those baby bells are screwing you because you're not getting a full speed. We're, regardless, you know, non-prejudicial, we're going to give you the full speed, whoever you are. And that's where...
No, but they can't. They can't see. That's the thing. I mean, some of the local cable companies, Louis, are opposed, are in favor of net neutrality. I mean, Google is in favor of net neutrality. Microsoft's in favor of net neutrality. The smaller local companies, they're going to get screwed because there's no way for them to make money on this thing.
Right. I know. I'd rather see the small guy win in the end anyhow.
I think we ought to do is we ought to just keep the laws that we have that have built the Internet that say that you can charge for data flowing through your pipe based on the amount of data. You can charge for access to the pipe if you want to put a web page up. You can charge to bring data down off the pipe. That is if you want to, you know, have Internet coming into your home or place of business. But you can't say to somebody, based on the content of your website, we're going to make it go faster or slower. Or based on how much you pay us, we're going to make it go faster or slower. It's a very dangerous, slippery slope.
I agree. That other caller was a very bright guy. I could tell he was in the industry because he talked the smack really well. And the thing is that what we're doing legislatively now, I know in state by state, we're trying to bypass the whole municipality thing and pass a state regulatory law, which we already have for phones. It's weird how the cable companies got stuck with county by county, city by city, which is very tedious. I got to say, it is a bureaucratic nightmare where the bells, you know, the big JB Bells over the years, I guess, had it passed where, hey, once we get regulated for Florida, that's it. We, you know, we're done.
Well, part of that was that the baby bells, the phone companies are required to provide a public service.
Exactly.
That public service is 911. Cable companies are required to provide a public service. See, and this is both in exchange for use of the public access, of the public rights away. Cable companies are required to offer a public service. That's local access, local public access. Now, 911 is something that can be absolutely made uniform across a state. So you can have a state regulation for 9/11. You can have a state agency making sure that everything is done with 9/11. But local community access for cable is going to vary from community to community. It's very different in New York City than it is in Camas, Washington, or a little town, you know, someplace.
Well, that's where over IP now is having a problem because if they don't have the 911 capability.
Yeah. Which is a whole other thing. And,
right. Hey, Louis, good talking, man. You're talking my language. At least it's fun.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Louis. Good to hear from you. Tom in Tyler, Texas. We have 1 minute, Tom. What's up?
Yes, I wanted to reply to that gentleman that laying the
cables that was talking about the right-of-ways.
Right. Now, keep in mind, that guy was in favor of net neutrality. He was just trying to clarify some technical points here, I guess.
Yeah, well, he was making it sound like that they own the right-of-ways, and to my knowledge, the only company that owns their right-of-ways is the railroads, unless they went to private individuals and purchased that property and had a deed for it. They do not own the right-of-ways.
That's right. They're renting
it. They're not owning the right-of-ways in a city or a corporation. And crossing a the worst thing to cross is railroad right-of-way. They're far worse than the government trying.
Yeah, and that's because the right-of-ways that the railroads got were all given to them back in the 1860s, 1870s, and 1880s. And that was largely because of the corruption of government. They corrupted government. I mean, it was the railroads that got the 1886 Santa Clara County decision before the Supreme Court, but that's a whole other thing. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. It's 57 minutes past the hour. After the break, who is Dick DeVos? Joel Wendland, Political Affairs Magazine, will give us all the details on Dick. You don't want to miss this one. We'll be back.
Been listening to the Tom Hartman program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Abraham Lincoln: America will never be destroyed from the outside. If we falter and lose our freedoms, it will be because we destroyed ourselves. Joel Wendland is with us. He's the managing editor of Political Affairs Magazine, politicalaffairs.net, the website. Joel, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Joel, you've written a piece recently about Dick DeVos, the billionaire co-owner of Amway who's running for governor in Michigan. We're on the air in Michigan, among others on WTKG in Grand Rapids, which is Dick's backyard there. And so I thought I'd, and I know a lot of our listeners have called in and said he's been carpet bombing the state. I'm originally from Michigan, in fact. Most of my family lives in Michigan. Carpet bombing the state with advertising. I'd like to just go through some of the charges that you've made and see if there's anything to them, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
DeVos has financial and personal ties to the Republican culture of corruption.
Yes. In 1999, he provided his private yacht for Tom DeLay to use for a major Republican fundraiser. This particular party was attended by no less a personage than convicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff. In those early years, in the 1999, 2000, 2001, he exchanged thousands of dollars through his PAC and through DeLay's PACs with DeLay. And we should recall that DeLay was indicted for conspiring to launder illegally acquired campaign funds, though Republican efforts to block serious ethics investigations and the foot-dragging of the Justice Department really hasn't tracked down all that money. So we don't know exactly, but it is definitely a credibility issue that Michigan voters need to know, because this is one of the very things that make us unable to trust Dick DeVos.
Dick DeVos, you said, believes in cutting jobs.
Yeah, as the CEO of Amway in the late 1990s, his company laid off about 1,300 workers. None of those jobs have returned to Michigan. A couple of years later, Amway announced a $220 million investment in manufacturing facilities in another country. And though he says in one of his commercials that you've talked about that he's a quote-unquote job maker, he's not really a job maker in Michigan. He's a job maker elsewhere. In Michigan, it appears that the real record, his real record, is that he is a job killer. And people have to take this into consideration when they hear these television ads.
Along the same lines, you say that he gets richer while Michigan workers suffer because he supports NAFTA and other free trade agreements, which cost Michigan 63,000 jobs.
Right. He, through a number of his PACs, lobbied Congress hard to pass a lot of deals like NAFTA. I mean, he's a big supporter of that kind of activity, movement of jobs overseas to increase profits for his company, as was the case that I just described.
Yeah, his company, Amway. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you said that DeVos dishonestly opposes Michigan's minimum wage increase. What is dishonest about his opposition to increasing the minimum wage?
Well, like a lot of people on the right who oppose increasing the minimum wage, he laid out a number of reasons for opposing it that just weren't true. He said that most minimum wage workers are just coming out of school, they're very inexperienced, and they don't really need higher wages. And the fact is, as the Economic Policy Institute has pointed out, that more than half of minimum wage earners bring in the majority of their household income. Many of them are single mothers. Many of them are, the vast majority, 75%, are over the age of 20. So the indication is that he doesn't really know who minimum wage earners are, and he doesn't seem too concerned about the struggles they face economically.
We're talking with Joel Wendland. He's the managing editor of Political Affairs Magazine, politicalaffairs.net. He's just written an op-ed piece called Who is Dick DeVos? Fascinating. Number five, Joel, you say Dick DeVos despises Michigan's public schools.
Yes, this one is the clincher, I think, for a lot of voters. Recently at a campaign stop in a suburban area outside of Detroit, he told some of his supporters that he wants to increase funding for education. But his record on that issue seems to indicate the opposite. He backed a campaign that he personally financed to gut Michigan public schools with a privatization scheme. And when Michigan voters turned that down in 2000, he told the Conservative Heritage Foundation a couple of years later that if he ever got the chance again, he would push that issue again really, really hard. And it's not really just an ideological issue for him. It appears, according to the Associated Press, that he owns stock or has investments in a private education company called K-12 Inc. that could financially benefit its shareholders and investors like DeVos if...
Right, just like his Amway company benefited from our free trade agreements that allowed him to move his jobs out of Michigan and offshore.
Right, right.
DeVos, you say, Dick DeVos thinks large corporations should not pay their fair share of Michigan's tax burden.
Right. He there's a couple of ways to look at it. While he was CEO, his family and his company gave about $4 million to the Republican Party. And in 1997, they received a big tax break from the Republican-controlled Congress, something like $283 million. Excuse me. And
invest $4 million in the Republican Party, and the Republican Party then inserts a tax loophole into what was it, 1997 federal budget bill?
Yes, exactly.
That gives Amway $283 million corporate tax break.
Right, and who knows how many schools in Michigan had to close because of that kind of activity. I mean, in my city, in Ypsilanti, they're talking about closing two elementary schools that serve hundreds and hundreds of families here. So, you know, we have to wonder what his real priorities are, despite what he's saying in this well-funded, highly slick, highly, like you say, carpet-bombed campaign.
You say he wants to eliminate Michigan's single business tax, which would benefit big companies like his, and increase the average taxes of average working families $800 a year?
Yeah, and that is the kind of views he has on taxes generally. Reduce taxes for the higher income brackets, and but he talks about it in terms of tax cuts, you know, helping out middle-class families. But the fact is, those kinds of tax cuts really increase the burden.
Now we've been hearing a lot about the so-called death tax. We had Grover Norquist, in fact, on this program a little while ago, and he was going on and on about the death tax. It's actually the Paris Hilton tax, the estate tax. And there are 18 families, I guess, who have been outed that collectively will save some $77 billion if this tax is repealed. You say that Dick DeVos, since 1988, has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in a covert effort to repeal the estate tax that will benefit him and his family?
Yeah, his family has supported this repeal of the estate tax for a very long time. And they've tried to claim, this campaign that they've financed, has tried to claim that the estate tax really affects small business owners and small farmers and working families, but it doesn't. It really only affects a very, very tiny fraction of the people in the country, and most of those are families like DeVos's who can afford and have a responsibility to pay their fair share to make our society run.
You say in your piece, Joel Wendland, editor of Political Affairs Magazine, politicalaffairs.net, we only have just about a minute left here, that Dick DeVos hides the truth about his wealth and that he supports the failed Republican ideology of tax cuts for the rich and deregulation.
Yeah, a number of commentators have pointed out elsewhere how he has personally benefited from deregulation of the energy industry. I can't really go into all the details of that, but he's a strong supporter of tax cuts for the rich and deregulation to make it so that companies can do slash-and-burn policies in Michigan, gut wages for workers, benefits for workers.
And he actually said on WILX, he said, "I will be disclosing to the people of Michigan that which I think is appropriate for them to understand."
Right. He refused.
With regard to his tax returns?
Right. He refused to disclose a lot of financial information and basically held an arrogant view that he doesn't need to.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, hopefully the voters of Michigan will wake up. Joel Wendland, and hopefully Jennifer Granholm will use some of this in her political advertising. Joel Wendland, the managing editor of Political Affairs Magazine, politicalaffairs.net. Joel, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I'll be doing the majority report tonight, by the way, and tomorrow night. We're going to be talking with Greg Gorman of the Talk Radio News in just a second. First, Virginia and Wyoming, Michigan. Apropos of our last guest, just wanted to make a follow-up comment. Hey, Virginia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to tell you that my daughter worked out at Amway a couple months ago. It's a $9 an hour job. It's a temp job that you have to every week check to see if you're coming back. And you can only stay a year.
Well,
and then you have to go.
Now, frankly, I have to say, I have a cousin who worked for Amway for a number of years and thought it was a pretty good job. But why this policy now?
Well, they got rid of a bunch of people over there. This is mostly, you know, just the labor part where you pack up all their little.
Yeah. My cousin was one of the executives there.
Yeah.
One of the white collar workers, anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. No. This was all the little people they got rid of, and then he brought temps in to fill that spot so that he doesn't have to give out any medical or anything.
Yeah, well.
And, you know, that's not a high-paying job. I mean,
yeah.
$9 an hour. I mean,
yeah.
And it's only temporary.
Yep, so.
I mean, I'm glad that this guy came on and told people what this man is really like because his, you know, he's all over everything here.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what I understand. Virginia, thanks a lot for the call, and I guess with regard to the practices there, all I can say is...
Surprise!
Yeah. Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Greg, what's up? Greg Gorman, Talk Radio News.
Hello, Tom. How are you today?
Hey, Greg, I'm very well today. Thank you very much.
Good.
But I'll get better. How about you?
Well, it's you know, hot and sticky here in the nation's capital, but it's that time of year, so what are you going to do?
What's happening in the belly of the beast today?
Well, a few things are happening. I have some Supreme Court news for you. Of course, we're all still talking about these two. Well, there's two big, you know, stories. One is the North Korean long-range missile issue. Apparently, it's gassed up and ready to go. And Tony Snow says that the U.S. has been speaking to the North Koreans at the UN in New York, but he won't give any more details. And of course, we're all waiting to find out if there is proof that this new, new terror group has indeed kidnapped two American soldiers in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Now the other big news is there are some pretty interesting rulings today from the Supreme Court. Although they're not in arguments, they have actually made some rulings. One is that if you are a parolee and you have agreed to be searched at any time as part of your parole, once you have signed that argument, you are allowed to be searched by the police at any time, even if there's no suspicion of wrongdoing. Other big issue is
The court has ruled this, or they've agreed to take on this to decide this?
No, it's ruled. It's ruled. They ruled this morning.
Once you say, yes, you can search me, they can search you forever?
If you are a parolee, and even though there's no hint of wrongdoing, the police are allowed
to... Oh, man, this is the death by a thousand paper cuts. I mean, first the no-knock warrants. I mean, there's going to be nothing left of civil rights in the United States with these guys.
Right, and you know what,
Is this another 5-4 ruling, Greg?
Let me tell you, the ruling number was... I have it right in front of me. 6-3.
6-3. Whoa. I wonder who they roped in.
And the other issue, the other interesting rulings have to do with 911 calls. And this is quite an interesting case. If you are a victim and you call into 911, but you do not show up to trial, your 911 call can be admitted as evidence. However, if you are at a crime scene and you offer a statement to the police, you know, in person, but then later do not show up to court, you cannot use that evidence as testimony. So that if you're on the phone making it, it can be evidence. If you're in person, it cannot be. And the interesting footnote to that is that they were both unanimous cases, except the in-person ruling was 8-1, and the one person who said that was Clarence Thomas. So he is still the most absolute conservative member of the court.
Yeah, let me see if I understand this right. My common sense take on this would be, if I call 911, it's me, the 911 operator, and a tape recorder.
Right.
So there's a clear record of what I said.
Exactly.
If on the other hand I'm in a crime scene and I'm talking with a police officer and I say, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, whatever, it's really just the police officer's word about what I said. There's not a tape recording.
Right, that's exactly right, and that's why.
And so the court's
the one. You have to still show up in court in order to restate your testimony or restate your statement.
Whereas a 911 call, hey, there's a recording of it. Here it is.
That's right.
What if the cop records what I say?
Well, you know what? I actually thought of that. I thought maybe in the future cops are going to have those little, you know, the handheld things that people use here in Washington if they're recording.
Yeah.
You know, someone like at a press conference, and then maybe that can be played back in court. Of course, you know, all this depends upon, that would have to be another case, and that hasn't been ruled on. But, you know, it's a good idea anyway.
Yeah, interesting. And I saw that the Supreme Court today decided to take on another abortion case.
They are going to take on one more partial birth abortion case in the new term in October because they're trying to sort out the rulings. They already have one, so this will be the second.
Interesting. And simply by calling it a partial birth abortion, we're using the right wing's language. These are actually late term abortions.
Ooh, Tom, you got me on that one. You're absolutely right.
27, that's okay. Greg Gorman, thanks for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
The New York Times is using their language, too. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
How many wrinkles in a pickle? How many hairs in a hair? How many waves in the ocean? How many crumbs in bread? But last but not least, baby, most of all, why do I mumble every time you call? Because you're strange to me, baby. You're in my corner.
And welcome back, my friends. 945 days, 11 hours, 25 minutes, 31 seconds until George W. Bush leaves office voluntarily, assuming that there is no impeachment, 34 minutes past the hour. Not necessarily a safe assumption. Welcome back to the program. Cal Thomas. Cal Thomas, the right-wing whack job who's been mostly writing articles for newspapers for years and years, a syndicated newspaper columnist. Now he's a regular on Fox News. Just kind of laying it out. He's like, what's interesting, within the last 24 hours, there has been this Cal Thomas clip that I'm going to share with you in just a second. And then also Jim Lehrer. Jim Lehrer was asked on some news program, I don't remember what it was, you know, is there a question to the effect of, is there still an opportunity for, you know, for news? Is there some niche, news niche, that's not being filled because you've got MSNBC and CNBC and CNN and Headline News and Fox and, network news? And Jim Lehrer said, yeah, somebody needs to be doing real news. Nobody's doing real news. There's an opportunity to make some money here. And Cal Thomas is sort of speaking to that here. He says basically that Fox News has the what he refers to as the trailer trash listener demographic, and that's it. And, you know, why is MSNBC competing for that? Here's Cal Thomas.
You touched on the important thing, the loss of identity. All of them are trying to copy Fox now, to be honest. Many of them are doing more tabloid, more big lip blondes and all this kind of stuff. There's only so much of that trailer trash pie to go around. And you've got to get out there and do the serious stuff once in a while.
Now, this is on Fox News. You know, he's talking about how everybody else is imitating Fox News' big-lipped blondes. And it's only... Oh, man, it's like, you know, every now and then it just kind of slips out, and you go, whoa, did he really say that? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Mark in Florence, Oregon. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Morning to you, Tom.
Good morning.
Oh, Tom, I was wondering if you'd heard about the, it's basically going to be the American Union by the year 2010.
Are you talking about the meeting in March of 2005, a year and a few months ago, that Vicente Fox, Paul Martin, and George Bush had down in Waco, Texas?
Exactly.
Where they signed this deal to build a highway from Canada to Mexico and allow Chinese ships to dock in Mexico without any longshoremen's union and put them on trucks that don't have any Teamsters union and drive them all the way up to New York City, stop in St. Louis on the way, stop in Kansas City on the way for customs inspection?
Yes, they've already allocated $3 million the Mexican government is actually paying for that, I believe,
yep,
for a customs house at Kansas City.
Yeah, and it goes beyond that. The state of Texas is negotiating with a Spanish company, not as in Spanish language, as in Spain, is negotiating with a Spanish company to convert chunks of I-35 into a toll road and privatize it.
That's right, Tom. It'll be 12 lanes wide, and it'll basically, I guess it'll take over I-35 or run right beside it. The agreement is signed. They expect to implement it by the year 2010.
You know what amazes me, Mark, is there is a whole world full of conservatives out there who have, ever since the 1920s, basically when Woodrow Wilson first proposed the League of Nations,
uh-huh,
and certainly since the 1940s, late 1940s when the United Nations was formed, have been absolutely hysterical about the idea of the United States surrendering any of its sovereignty by signing a treaty that would create the League of Nations. The Republicans kept us out of the League of Nations, and then finally we got into the United Nations, through the efforts of Truman and Eisenhower, oddly enough, but signing a treaty approved by Eisenhower, let's say, signing a treaty that would give up sovereignty, because now, before we can declare war on another country, we have to agree to international rules.
Well,
yet we've given up our sovereignty with NAFTA, CAFTA, the WTO, and GATT.
Yeah. It's all part of their game plan to give up the sovereignty of this country. Of course, Tom, as you well know, they are neocons, not conservatives. They're actually neocons. So they're very radical in their policies to implement the major policies of their philosophy.
Yeah, I'm just wondering where the old conservatives are talking about this. Why are not the conservative websites freaking out about this?
Well, Tom, I think they've all jumped on the bandwagon along with George Bush. He's had such great success, and perhaps the ones that that don't agree with him totally, or even for the most part, are actually hoping to have some success in implementing or re-implementing some true conservative values sometime in the future. Maybe it's the only game in town for them, but I think this is going to give up what sovereignty is left in this country, because I think part of the agreement is it's going to be modeled after the European Union, and that we'll all be under the same legal code.
Yeah, and the European Union, and I got to tell you, the European Union is having some serious problems right now, because, you know, individual nation states trying to maintain sovereignty, trying to hold their cultures intact, trying to keep their economies intact.
That's right.
Really serious problems.
And they had a vote in Europe before the European Union was implemented, and actually the people of Europe turned it down, but they went ahead and implemented it anyway. I doubt if we'll even get a chance to have a vote in this country the way things are being kind of steamrolled over the people.
Yeah, there's a reason why the Danes and the Finns and the Brits, for that matter, with regard to the currency, are not all that enthusiastic about it. Mark, thanks for the call.
Thank you, Tom.
Got to move along. Justin in Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Justin.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Good. I was looking on the internet yesterday, and I just saw this graphic, and it was really interesting to me, and it showed, I think you've mentioned it before, you said something about the four or five biggest companies in America that have owned, you know, all the smaller companies, and it showed kind of like what Viacom owns and, you know, what Disney owns and all that kind of stuff. To me, it looked really scary because, you know, if any one of those companies decides they want to do something, you know, crazy, you know, all these other small companies are going to have to follow suit. What I was going to ask you is, what are your views on capitalism getting, or a certain point where companies get too big, and is there a point where our forefathers, you know, put something into the Constitution where they can't get that big?
Yeah. Well, Jefferson wanted something like that. He wanted what he called a limit on monopolies to be written in the Constitution. In fact, when he wrote the first draft of the 10 amendments to the Constitution that we know of as the Bill of Rights, there were two items in those 10 that didn't make it. And he sent this in a letter over to James Madison in 1787. He was then in France. He was the U.S. envoy to France. And he suggested that these two items were, number one, that there should be a ban on standing armies. He said armies are always a source of mischief during peacetime. And so he wanted us to have, like Switzerland does, he wanted us to have a national militia where every able-bodied male would have to serve, you know, 6 months or a year, basically basic training, and would keep a gun in the house. And then if there was a national emergency, you could mobilize the militia, but otherwise everybody was a civilian, so there's no standing army. And I continue to think that that was a good idea and that he was right, and it's worked well for Switzerland, number one. And number two, in fact, that's why Germany didn't invade Switzerland, because they knew that every man in Switzerland is part of the army. I mean, you invade the country, and suddenly the entire country is the army. That doesn't work, you know, for the invaders. And number two, he wanted there to be a ban on monopolies. Oh, by the way, with regard to Jefferson's item number one, not only did that not pass, but a fragment of it actually did. A fragment of his proposal did, and that's what we call the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment was the compromise that was worked out from Jefferson's proposing a ban on armies. And that was that, you know, he said every person should have a gun so that they can be part of the militia. And the Second Amendment says, you know, in order to facilitate a well-regulated militia, the government shall not, you know, inhibit the right of citizens to bear arms or own a bear. I forget the exact language, but words to that effect.
Right.
A lot of people don't know that that's what the Second Amendment was all about. It had nothing to do with people having the ability to overthrow their government or defend themselves or anything else. Number one. Number two, Jefferson wanted a ban on monopolies. And Madison replied and said, wrote back to him and said, you know, we really don't need to have a ban on monopolies on corporations owning other corporations or behaving in a monopolistic way, because the word corporation doesn't even exist in the Constitution. Corporations are not federally chartered. Corporations are chartered at the level of the state. And every single state at that time had laws that said that, number one, a corporation could only live for 20, 30, or 40 years, depending on the state. None of them were more than 40 years. They figured a corporation should have to, you know, should not live longer than the productive lifespan of a human. And at the end of that time, it should be probated. In other words, dissolved, and then, you know, the stockholders can reform it, but they have to pay taxes on it. Number two, a corporation can't engage in more than one kind of business. You can create a company to run a railroad. You can create a company to build matchboxes. You can, matches. You can build a company. You can create a company to make steel, but only one thing. Number three, a company cannot own other companies, cannot own stock in other companies. Number four, a corporation has to, as its first statement of business, serve the public good. Number five, and if it doesn't, it's dissolved. Number five, its books have to be open to the government, to the people at all times. And Madison was right in pointing all this out to Jefferson. These were all the state laws. And so Jefferson backed off and said, okay, you know, because he was concerned that if they got into the business of regulating corporations at the federal level, that it may end up being corrupted and corporations would actually seize power. And that was pretty much the way it was until the 1880s. And then during the 1880s, as a result of the rise of the railroads, which is the consequence of the Civil War, and the rise of the Standard Oil Trust, really it was John Rockefeller, Standard Oil Trust, Ohio came to him and said, what you're doing is illegal. And he said, and we're going to shut you down. And he said, well, what state will take me then? What state will change their laws? And Delaware, Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey all changed their laws to allow, to basically get rid of all those things I just listed.
Right.
And you know, that was the beginning of what's called the charter mongering era, all these corporations states changing their corporate charter laws. So, anyhow, I hope I've answered your question, Justin. I got to move along, but appreciate the call. 45 minutes past the hour. This is all in my book on equal protection, by the way. Tom Hartman with you.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
So hey, there's a new American way. No one serving those deserving, but there's less tax to pay. We abuse our might and mock the world as we say. Don't mess with the U.S. of A. Don't mess with the U.S. of A. The Sunshine State, how the scales got tipped to seal Al's fate. Jeb Bush winked, I told you so. And the butterfly flew into Palm Beach for Al and Joe got one punch each. 10,000 Gore votes cast aside before you know.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number right here on your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Speaking of which, Armin in Bradenton, Florida, one of the sanest callers we have. Hey, Armin.
Thank you. I first want to say this. When the rich always win, somebody lesser always loses.
Yeah, it seems that there is a certain element of zero-sum game to it all. There is something to be said for the idea that we can't expand the pie or make the pie higher, to quote George Bush. But there is a zero-sum game element in there, too.
All right, I'd like to explain how most of us are effectively paying $12 a gallon for gas.
Okay.
If we're getting health care, it's crappy health care.
Mm-hmm.
It harms more people than any other system in the world.
Yep.
And it's the most expensive. And we constantly have 60 million people that don't have access to it, affordable.
Right.
Okay. Average people in this country that drive 10,000 miles a year, so that's 500 gallons.
Okay.
Okay.
You mean at 20 miles per gallon?
Right, 20 miles per gallon. Boy, you're smart. That's 500 gallons the average person that drives consumes a year.
Mm.
Okay, we're spending over $200 billion a year for illegal and legal. A lot of people don't realize it, but a lot of these legal people they bring in here with these programs, they subsidize them with taxpayers' health insurance and all kinds of things, housing allowances and stuff. So we're spending $200 billion a year at least for the support the illegals that make a wage they can't support themselves on, and the legals that come in here that need subsidies from the rest of us because they don't pay them enough to support themselves. So then you take $150 billion a year we're spending to be over in the Mideast and oppress the prices of oil and keep the prices up for the oil companies that own Bush. And then you take another $150 billion, and that is how much we're spending on the permanent welfare class that aren't capable of getting degrees in college, and the jobs that they can do are being moved out of the country by the corporations. So you add all that together, and it comes up to $6,000, and at 500 gallons, that works out to $12 a gallon. We're effectively playing for this racket called the United States of America and corporation controlling the government.
Interesting. Interesting. Armin, I think you could make a really strong case for building into the cost of oil the cost of our adventure in Iraq, you know, $200 billion a year. I think you could build a really strong case for that. I'm not sure I'd go with you.
No, I'm $150 billion a year.
$150 billion a year, okay.
$150 billion a year above and beyond what is bare minimally needed for, if you could take it out to the highest degree and logically explain that it's to protect our... freedom.
Yeah. And so at $150 billion a year, and there's about 110 million working people in the United States, let's say that there was 150 million, that would be about $1,000 per working person, right? If I'm doing my math right?
Yeah.
Okay.
$1,000 per billion. So I did the math. I come up to 4,500, with the illegals and legal subsidies, the permanent welfare class and the military footprint and everything that doesn't need to be. I come up with 4,500 plus the 1,500 at $3 a pump at 500 gallons. That works out to 6,000, which is $12 a gallon we're paying. These people in the media, the reason why they don't say a lot is because they rule.net. Go look. They're all on each other's boards. It should have never been allowed.
I'm right there with you, Armin. And good point and well made. And theyrule.net, by the way, is the website to check this out on. You've got to check this thing out. By the way, the New York Times, and thank you, Armin, for the call. The New York Times today, an amazing piece in the New York Times about it was yesterday, about, you know, what's going on with these folks who are working for the defense industry. Yes, working for the defense industry, collecting bigger paychecks in different roles. At least 90 officials of the Department of Homeland Security, or the White House Office of Homeland Security, this is from Eric Lipton, at least 90 officials, including the department's former Secretary Tom Ridge, the former Deputy Secretary Admiral James Lloyd, former Undersecretary Asa Hutchinson, are executives, consultants, or lobbyists for companies that collectively do billions of dollars worth of business in domestic security. More than two-thirds of the department's most senior executives in its first years have moved through the revolving door. This is Department of Homeland Security. More than two-thirds of their most senior executives have figured out a way to cash in on this thing. This is mind-boggling. By the way, my Reclaim the Issues, Occupation Not War piece is up on commondreams.org, what we were talking about last week, about how whenever anybody says it's a war in Iraq, we should say, no, sorry, it's an occupation, not a war. And we absolutely need to reclaim these issues and the use of the word war by the Bushies. Frank Rich in the New York Times yesterday, the same thing. Karl Rove beats the Democrats again, makes the same point. So incredible. They're using war to gain electoral victories, and then they're building this huge Department of Homeland Security, and then they get out of the Department of Homeland Security and go to work for big corporations, in some cases making millions of dollars. One guy, $934,000 a year, Carol DeBattiste, $150,000 from Deputy Secretary of Transportation, Secretary of Administration, to $934,000 last year at Choice Point, which just happens to have securities or contracts with Homeland Security. What a surprise. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after this.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friend. 6 minutes past the hour, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a clean election. Tom Hartman radio program. That's me. Glad to be here with you. Following up on our last caller, Kevin, in San Diego, California, I'm assuming that you wanted to respond to something Armin had said.
Absolutely. I wanted to respond to that individual who was talking about people who are permanent welfare recipients. And I don't think there is any such animal. I think that people basically, you know, that can't afford to improve their situation. They can't afford a college tuition, you know, thanks to previous administrations as well as the current Bush administration. And to sit up and make a blanket indictment and just say that, you know, people are, you know, are permanent welfare recipients, that they don't aspire to higher education and so forth, I think basically, you know, it's facts of bigotry. And I think that there's a lot of that going around. And I would just suggest for that individual to read a book. It's called The Color of Wealth. It's by a woman of Asian descent. I believe her name is Mai Zhu. I may be pronouncing the name
incorrectly. It's actually a collection of authors. I have a copy of it.
Absolutely.
It's an anthology.
Yeah. Basically, it dispels this whole myth about black people, because basically that's the root of this whole thing.
Kevin, in defense of Armin, let me just tell you where he was coming from, because he calls the program fairly regularly. And and the first time he said that, the permanent underclass, he said a permanent welfare underclass because their jobs have all been shipped overseas.
Right.
What he's talking about is people who would... And maybe I shouldn't be defending Armin here, but what I believe he was talking about, because God only knows, because you're right, this is a phrase that right-wingers use as a code word for either racism or classism.
Absolutely.
But I think that what Armin was talking about is the fact that the Bush administration and these international trade policies are creating a permanent economic underclass in the United States.
Absolutely. I agree with that totally, Tom. And you know, you may be correct, but the thing is we have to be careful about the choice of words that we use. Yeah, and then also, I guess I'm a little sensitive to this because I am a black man in this country, you know, who served in the armed forces, you know. And I think in light of what's going on as far as Hurricane Katrina, they just released this report about the abuses and so forth, but what about the abuses on the part of the contractors and so forth? What about George Bush suspending Davis Bacon and then giving those jobs to illegal aliens? I mean, people throw out a lot of euphemisms about pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and personal responsibility, but then here's an opportunity for the president to give some of those jobs down in New Orleans to people so that they could rebuild their lives. I mean, insurance companies, you know, basically scamming these homeowners and so forth and these cars that were in the hurricane being resold. They just had a press conference out here a couple of months ago by Commissioner John Garamendi where he was talking about some of these car dealerships who were actually reselling cars that were in Hurricane Katrina. He was reselling those, or these dealerships were reselling those to make a profit off that. So what about those abuses? You know, and I think that all
they're not covered in the newspaper. I agree with you, Kevin, and I was really amazed to see the level of coverage in the mainstream media of, you know, $1 billion in abuses and, you know, $200 Hooters is given back. And like you say, nobody's talking about the contractors. Nobody's talking about him suspending Davis Bacon. You're absolutely right.
I mean, it's just basically, it's like, you know, we're throwaway people. It's like basically, you know, we're an easy target. You know, I mean, it's like basically everybody's just piling on. Piling on, and nobody's really looking at the big picture. And like I said, I would just recommend for anyone who has that mindset. And again, I want to accuse this individual of being a bigot. But I mean, his comments, you know, they kind of struck a nerve with me. And anybody who is a bigot, I would suggest they read that book, The Color of Wealth. And basically, it would dispel a lot of misconceptions that people have about the welfare systems and entitlements and so forth.
Yeah, I well said, Kevin. Thank you very much. In fact, we had the woman who was the editor who pulled that thing together here on the program about 3 weeks ago, which is why I'm, you know, familiar with it right off the top of my head. But well said. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call, and good to hear from you. Let's check out what's happening with the occupation in Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lies in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the camp. And there is blood on the wire.
As from Reuters, in the last 24 hours in Baghdad, the Mujahideen Shura Council, a group linked to Iraq's al-Qaeda, said it had abducted two U.S. soldiers south of Baghdad who went missing on Friday after an attack at a checkpoint. Also, Dateline Baghdad, the group said it was holding four Russian diplomats hostage in Iraq and gave Moscow 48 hours to pull out of Chechnya and free Muslim prisoners. On June 3rd, a Russian embassy employee was shot dead in Baghdad and four others were abducted. In Ramadi, helicopters flew over the Iraqi town of Ramadi, and warplanes could be heard overhead as U.S. troops hunted down insurgents in that rebel stronghold. Baghdad, a car bomb targeting a police checkpoint in southern Baghdad killed three people and wounded three. In Najaf, one person was killed and five wounded when a roadside bomb exploded near the Shiite city of Najaf. In Baghdad, a suicide car bomber killed four civilians and wounded 10 when he detonated his vehicle near an Iraqi army checkpoint in central Baghdad. And in Karbala, gunman killed a senior police officer and wounded two of his bodyguards in the holy Shiite city of Karbala. And Republicans continue to insist that Iraq is safer than Washington, D.C. Paul in Anchorage, Alaska. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Oh, what I wanted to do was to clarify your position on the ethics of going in and, regardless of the collateral damage, blowing up someone like Zarqawi, who is suspected of being a criminal. We're not sure that he is a criminal. We're not sure of what he's done.
Paul, haven't we had this conversation before?
You bet we have. And
oh, okay.
You know what?
All right, Paul, I'm sorry. I'm all done with the conversation. It's you know, I've said what I have to say on it. Jack Murtha. Karl Rove comes out and says, this is the battle that the Republicans, there are two issues that the Republicans are going to use in November. And if they rig enough voting machines and if they disenfranchise enough voters, I'm telling you, these are going to be the issues that the press is going to tell us. This is why the Republicans won big in November. One of them is the whole illegal immigration issue. And as George Will pointed out, I think tragically, correctly, in the Washington Post over the weekend, we're already seeing this happen in Pennsylvania, where Bob Casey's being beat up by Rick Santorum for advocating amnesty. Right? That's gonna bite him. And the other is people saying we want to lose a war. And as I point out in today's Common Dreams, the war is over. It was an illegal war. It was the wrong war. It should never have happened. But the fact of the matter is, the war is over. Our army is very good at killing people and blowing things up, which is what armies do. Toppling governments, seizing control of them. We did that. In May of 2003, when Bush stood up on that aircraft carrier and declared hostilities over.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
He was right. He was right. We overthrew a government. We destroyed an army. We killed off the Republican Guard. End of war. What began the day after that was the beginning of the occupation of Iraq. And every day and every time that a Democrat uses the phrase war in Iraq, they are supporting the frame that Karl Rove is out there pushing absolutely as hard as he can. It's a war. It is not a war. It's an occupation. There is a world of difference between the two. Americans and people of all other nations hate losing wars. And if you come along and you say, I'm in favor of us losing this war, you're going to be killed politically. Even if people don't like the war, they don't want to lose it. And when you throw into that equation the fact that probably 75% of American voters don't even pay attention to politics until 3 weeks or a month before the election, you've got, you know, just a ferocious thing. Here's John Murtha responding on Meet the Press here to Karl Rove. Karl Rove and then Jack Murtha.
Like too many Democrats, it strikes me they are ready to give the green light to go to war, but when it gets tough, and when it gets difficult.
So you notice here, Karl Rove, he's talking about this occupation as if it's the continuation of a war.
They fall back on that party's old pattern of cutting and running.
No, we're trying to end an occupation. Here's Jack Murtha.
You can't sit there in the air-conditioned office and tell these troops they're carrying 70 pounds on their back inside the armored vessels and hit with IEDs every day, seeing their friends blown up, their buddies blown up, and he says, stay the course. Yeah, it's easy to say that from Washington, D.C.
Yeah, there you go, Jack Murtha, giving the old what's for to Karl Rove, sitting on his I think he referred to Rove's big behind or big backside or something. But the reality is that as long as any Democrat continues to say yes, this is a war, it's going to make it politically very, very difficult to end this occupation, because it is an occupation, not a war. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
The Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar. I am following the river down the highway through the cradle of the Civil War. I'm going to Graceland.
Korizumi is going to Graceland. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Alex DeBro is with us. He's the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCA. Online.com is the website. Hey, Alec.
.org, Tom. .org.
.org.
Oh, right.
Thank you very much.
And
I'd
like to tell people to go to that. It's newly revised. Its content is intelligent. The graphics are imaginative, maybe brilliant. And did I mention that I did it?
Okay. IlcaOnline.org.
Okay.
There you go. All right. Alec DeBro. Now, I have had people call this program and email me about TV ads that they are seeing in their community from this group, UnionFacts.com, the 12.5 million facts union officials don't want you to know, and total union staff compensation in 2004, $3.7 billion, major unions with male presidents, 95%, total unfair labor practices filed against unions since 2000, 43,000. They go on and on and on with this stuff. EOC discrimination against unions, $30,000, $6 million in fines paid by unions. I mean, what's the deal?
What's the deal is that somebody, a guy named Rick Berman, has gotten a lot of money for what is a brilliant scam. What he does is simply go to the Department of Labor's accountings on unions and publicizes it as if it were secret information. The truth is that the labor movement, even though diminished, is still a very large movement, and it includes people who do things wrong. So it's much more closely watched in many respects than...
Yeah, you've got 12.5 million unionized people in the United States. I would imagine that if we looked at 12.5 million, white-collar workers, non-unionized white-collar workers, we could find a few thousand of them who are up to no good as well.
I would suspect so, and in terms of organizations, I'm not sure that malfeasance in labor unions is any more widespread than it is among religious organizations. But the truth is, nobody's trying to do away with religion. This guy really works with people who want to eliminate labor unions. It isn't simply that there are things that need to be fixed for him. Plus, he's monkeying with the statistics. He listed the president of the National Education Association as having a salary of over $400,000. In fact, it's less than half that. What he was doing was conflating travel expenses and salary and coming up with his figure. And in truth, union presidents or union officials, at least in Washington, their salaries are pretty much commensurate with mid-level nonprofits. They make more than the rank and file people for the most part, but they are not outrageous salaries by any means. It's just that the hatred behind this is so palpable, and now that he's running TV spots in addition to newspaper ads, it means it is reaching a lot of people. I mean, they're fairly lame spots. I took a look at one of them, and they're not well acted, but the truth is advertising doesn't have to be. It just has to be repetitive.
Right. So who is this Rick Berman guy?
He's fascinating. He considers himself, he says he's socially liberal, economically conservative. He's worked for trade associations like the National Restaurant Association and the tobacco people. And he's done public advertising. He's got one now advising people that it's really pretty much okay to eat mercury in fish because there isn't that much of it. He had a campaign in favor of obesity, saying it was just a myth. And on tobacco, he was doing similar things, and he did a campaign against Mothers Against Drunk Driving. All of this he considers to be consumer choice.
Sounds like you're a generic libertarian.
I guess he can call himself that if he wishes. He's certainly, it's consumer.
So here we've got this libertarian guy who can rationalize his behavior with the particularly peculiarly sociopathic worldview that is characteristic of libertarians.
Right.
And somebody's handed him a handful of cash to take down the labor union movement.
Right.
What are you guys going to do about it?
What are we going to do about it? It's a tough one. One is that we don't really want to get into an argument on the facts with him because the truth is he distorts it. He has the way.
Well, I would think you wouldn't even want to elevate what he's doing. You wouldn't want to draw attention to it, except that he's got enough money now. It must be like Walmart money behind him or something.
Well, the interesting thing is he refuses to divulge where the money's coming from.
Interesting.
There's some good speculation that it's coming from Chamber of Commerce or Chamber of Commerce offshoots.
Yeah.
I think that, in fact, it's one of these major right-wing donors.
Yeah, probably is. Alec Dubrow, the website ilcaonline.org. Alec, thanks a lot. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We found a better way of making it seem clean. We built an electronic voting machine, and then we sold these suckers nationwide. But we're the only ones who know what's on the inside. You push the buttons and our voting machine keeps track. We made it so it's very easy to hack. Call for a recount, it will probably fail, but our machines don't leave no paper trail. The billionaires don't want you to vote this year, but send your message that's loud and clear that the votes can't be counted in your community. Why even register? Don't waste your energy. Don't go to the polls on election day, because we bought the election and it better go our way. And on election night, we'll sit back and gloat. The billionaires don't want you to vote.
Don't vote.
If you're happy with George Bush in charge.
Don't vote.
If you want to keep us living large.
Don't vote.
Do you really want to rock the boat?
Don't vote.
Hey, the billionaires don't want you to vote.
And welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Yeah, the billionaires for Bush, they definitely don't want you to vote. And if you do, you get to vote on their machines. Mark Carlin is with us. He's the editor-in-chief over at BuzzFlash.com, editor and founder. Hey, Mark.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Great to have you with us. BuzzFlash.com, of course, one of the premier progressive news and opinion sites. Is that an accurate description?
I hope so. We'll leave that up to our readers, but we try to achieve that level of competence.
Yeah, and I think you're doing a fine job. Murtha on Rove, he's sitting in his air-conditioned office on his big, fat backside saying, stay the course, that's not a plan. It's up at the top of BuzzFlash.com. Do you think that this is the biggest story here, Mark, right now, the war?
Absolutely. We have to understand that this is Groundhog Day, basically. The Bush administration, Rove saw that film and liked it. And every election, this will be the third election, they're playing from the same playbook, which is to instill fear. We saw this with a week of Al Zarqawi death mask coverage. And then not only did they kill him, which you would think after building him up would lead to some alleviation of our fear, but immediately they replaced him with another bogeyman.
Right.
So Rove, you know, uses this every, he's used this playbook of instilling fear in the country and saying the Iraq war is the battle for the war on terror. If we don't win there, they'll be at our shores. And the Democrats have caved in. Here we have John Murtha. You quoted one of his quotes. He was on a couple of news programs yesterday, and he went much further. This guy just tells it like it is. He visits the veterans' hospitals. He's been in Iraq, and he says, we're losing. You know, the Bush administration is lying. These are people who've never been in combat. I have. They're betraying our soldiers. And as we wrote in a news commentary in BuzzFlash today, crusty old Marine, Congressman John Murtha, we're in your platoon and we're going to follow you anywhere.
There you go. Well, and in fact, I published an op-ed piece today that suggests, and this is something I've been saying on the radio for a couple of weeks, and people keep saying, yeah, when are the Democrats? In fact, I talked with five members of Congress about it last week, and I got three of them to go, yeah, that makes sense. Harry Reid didn't seem to get it, but in any case, when I talked with him on Tuesday of last week, but that we're no longer in a war in Iraq. The war in Iraq ended in May of 2003. War is when you war ends when you defeat the enemy army and you overthrow their government and take their lands. And we did that. We had a successful war. We're now 3 years into an occupation. And as long as Democrats keep using the word war, they're going to lose because Karl Rove is going to say, oh, the Democrats want you to lose this war. And even Americans who hate war don't like to lose wars. Whereas if we can get Democrats to start using the word occupation, well, of course, every occupations always have to end.
Well, the Republicans, as you know, Tom, and we've discussed this, and you certainly are in agreement, and BuzzFlash and many other sites point this out to the Democrats. The Republicans win in how they define the terms, the language they use, and particularly the story they tell. The story they tell is of these bogeymen who they tie to 9/11. Al-Zarqawi was never tied to 9/11. As bad a guy as he may have been, no one ever accused him of being tied to 9/11. And, in fact, there is speculation that he was actually estranged from Osama bin Laden. Saddam Hussein was not tied to 9/11. The new guy that's taken over from al-Zarqawi is not tied to 9/11. These are terrorists that we've created. And the Democrats, like Harry Reid, who basically don't fight back on the Iraq issue, or Hillary Clinton, better known as the six-monthers, a phrase used from Thomas Friedman, which is the groundhog phrase that, oh, we'll see in 6 months how things are going.
Right.
Well, we've heard this for 3 years from all these Democrats and from Bush, and here you have John Murtha who's basically saying this is a bunch of BS. These are guys who have never been in combat. They're just feeding us a line. Our soldiers are getting killed. He's speaking up for the GIs. There's no question that John Murtha also speaking up for many people at mid-level in the Pentagon and even higher who think that the Bush administration has been a disaster for the military, not just in Iraq, but for the entire military infrastructure, from not having enough bulletproof vests to armored Humvees, a complete disaster for the military. We're talking about a crusty hawk that you and I and progressives like us normally wouldn't be warming up to. But this guy is coming off as the hero because he's speaking up for the soldiers and the GIs. He's saying we've been sold a bill of goods. That's all the Democrats have to do. They just have to tell truth to power.
Yeah, and finally John Kerry has spoken up, but too little too late.
I think it's too little too late, but it's a good sign that someone's talking up. I think he wants to position himself vis-a-vis Hillary Clinton as a anti-war candidate. I think he's a little late for that. But I think Hillary Clinton has played so cautious that she's going to have a very hard time in the primaries. And so while one pragmatically, quote-unquote, may say she's positioning herself for the general election, she probably will lose in the primaries to an insurgent candidate.
Well, she has plenty of time between now and then to reinvent herself. She needs to get herself elected to the U.S. Senate.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, this is a fundamental issue. You've pointed out, we've pointed out on BuzzFlash. Let's get beyond the politics. We need a public policy debate on what is going to actually ensure national security. Either you believe that this fiasco, this absolute tragic burlesque of a war in Iraq that Bush has created makes it safer or less safe. You've got to decide about that. You can't be in the middle on that. And if you think it makes us more safe, then you are a person, as far as BuzzFlash is concerned, who helps Bush threaten the national security of the United States through his absolute incompetence. If you feel it's making us less safe, then you have to be like John Murtha and speak out against what is happening, because by speaking out, you're helping to try to protect all of our lives in the United States. And there really is no choice. So those Democrats who sit back and say, we can't speak out against the war, it's too dangerous, you know, it's a national security issue, they're betraying the security of the United States and enabling Bush in betraying that, and they have to be held accountable for that, too.
Yeah, well said. And the point that I made last week, somebody called about, you know, Hillary, and I said, you know, people are dying every day. As long as people are dying every day, it's time to speak up. I mean, it's just the bottom line. We're talking with Mark Carlin. He's the editor and founder of BuzzFlash.com, the progressive news and opinion website. A shocking U.S. cable in the Washington Post shows how bad things really are in Baghdad, Mark.
Once again, and John Murtha is saying, you know, we have a propaganda war that the Bush cartel feeds us. Karl Rove, as we pointed out, knows very well that you personalize this. You make these bad men. You show the death mugshot of al-Zarqawi for a week. You bring up little news nuggets to keep the story going for a week, even though he had nothing to do with 9/11. Bad guy, but nothing to do with 9/11. The Bush administration is again resurrecting 9/11 in relationship to the Iraq War. Nothing to do with 9/11. Okay. Even people in our embassy, based on the article you're referring to, which originally was in the Washington Post, are saying how bad it is there. We talked with a guy named Nir Rosen, who's a journalist. You're probably familiar with him. Wrote a book called In the Belly of the Green Bird, who somehow miraculously went around and was able to interview most of the major insurgent groups in Iraq. And they're all over the place. The reality is, we interviewed them last week, that there's virtually no one except the puppet government in Iraq who supports the American presence there. We aren't fighting terrorists. As you said, we're fighting people who see us as occupiers.
Well, even the puppet government in Iraq, last week when Bush was in Iraq, the vice president of Iraq came up to him and said, I'd like a date for withdrawal.
That's absolutely right.
And it was not well reported here.
In order for them to survive in a country that's hostile to the very U.S. presence, even the puppet regime has to do that now and then in order for them to get away with their own lives, even though they stay with inside the green zone for the most part. But, you know, Bush flew over there, and we reported on our site just quotations from the New York Times and the Washington Post. And what they do now is report this as entertainment, not as public policy, whether the Iraq war is going well or not, or whether there's any reason to be there at all, whether it's doing damage to the country, that it's cost $327 billion. You can't find that, but this is what the New York Times said. Cheryl Gay Stolberg. It was powerful political theater, choreographed by an experienced team that played up the drama and secrecy of the moment. The Washington Post said Bush took full command of the political stage with his five-hour appearance in Baghdad. These people belong on the entertainment page, not as political reporters.
Well said. But you guys are doing a great job of political reporting.
You too, Tom.
Thank you. BuzzFlash.com, Mark Carlin. Good talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And who's going to be the one to say it was no good what we done?
I dare a man to say I'm too young, for I'm going to try for the sun.
And welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. A little earlier we heard from Cal Thomas saying that Fox News was going after the, to quote Cal Thomas, big-lipped blonde trailer trash crowd. And here's Tony Snow, formerly of Fox News, talking pretty much probably the way they talk inside Fox News about, you know, okay, we've talked enough about this topic. We need to change the... Right here, here he is.
The thing is, the way the war is being covered, and we've seen it right now, we have two U.S. servicemen. And bless them. We hope they're okay. We're focusing on them, and we forget that since Zarqawi was killed, hundreds of bad guys have been rounded up. There's been a lot of intelligence. The Iraqis have gone ahead and mobilized 50,000 of their own to go into five Baghdad neighborhoods. There's a lot going on there.
We're paying too much attention to these two guys who got kidnapped. Oh, terrible thing, isn't it? Just a terrible thing. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. It's getting so past the pale. I might even decide to try to run for something.
Well, that would be great. We need more good people in elected office.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm being a little facetious. I have to be honest. I don't have the track record, but boy, I wish. Oh well.
Well, the way you start out, the way you figure it out is you volunteer to work in somebody else's campaign, and then you learn the ropes.
Yeah, you got to walk before you run.
Yeah. I mean, look at John Roberts. He used to clerk for Rehnquist. Yeah. Now he's Chief Justice.
Yeah. 3 points, if I may. And I just I appreciate you taking the call. I really do. Because to be frank with you, I know I'm just going to guess. I don't know you personally, but I know we're on the same wavelength, basically. And that is this, that as I mentioned before, these are my words. You have to be strong. To be strong abroad, you have to be strong at home. And it just came to me just like the last couple of days, believe it or not, that where were the weakest? I almost think they're weakest because we just cannot get to the voting booth, the middle and upper middle income people, and make this change.
Well, the reality, Gary, I think, is if you're talking about voting, is that we have won the last few elections. The fundamental problem
we were cheated.
Yeah. I mean, democracy is number one. And number two, we need a fundamental retake on reapportionment. We need to redraw these congressional districts and just, arbitrarily and make them nice square boxes and do it the way the founders intended rather than all this gerrymandering, which has been, by the way, something promulgated by both Democrats and Republicans over the years. Your next point.
Yeah, and the only thing where I disagree, I think we've come to the point. Now, I know this is tough. Where you had mentioned that your approach is, and I agreed with it initially, we can't, you wish not to have blood drop on the floor, if you will, verbally. But I think we've almost come to the point where if it falls on the floor, let it be.
Well, my point, when I say we need to be able to debate conservatives without there being blood on the floor afterwards, is that when you resort to name-calling, when you resort to hitting below the belt, then not only do you not win, but you eliminate any possibility of future discussion.
Okay, one more thing, if I may, and I am going to quote Theodore Roosevelt, if I may. Here's what he said. He said, it's the politician, maybe I'll put person in there, who speaks in the loudest voice about what the people are thinking the most.
Yeah. Well, and that's what we need. We need more politicians who do that. Gary, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Stuart in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Stuart.
Yes, you're talking about the propaganda war, and you made an excellent point about stopping calling it the war in Iraq, but call it the occupation. We can't win an occupation. We always think we need to win a war.
Right.
But you also referred to...
And in fact, people logically want to end occupations.
Exactly.
It's a healthy thing to end an occupation.
You also used another phrase that we need to stop using. You talked about the revolving door and the defense contractors. The defense contractors are not defending us one bit. They're robbing us blind, as is the so-called Defense Department.
You make a good point, Stuart, but they're contracting with the Defense Department. What should we call them? War contractors?
Call them the military. That's a nice neutral term that works for everyone. So it's the U.S. military and military contractors. That way we can make it clear this is not about defending. This is military. It could be defending if it was used right, but it's not.
Yeah. Good point, Stuart. I will do my best to start, self-editing or whatever the, you know, whatever the phrase
military
is.
Contractors, U.S. military.
The other phrase that I'd like to see used more often and that I need to be using myself more often is war profiteers.
Yes.
We certainly have a, certainly have a problem with that.
Another advantage of talking about defense, I mean, excuse me, there I go, military contractors.
See how easy it is?
It fits in with the Eisenhower's military-industrial complex speech that a lot of people have some familiarity with.
You're right, and I play every 6 months or so on this program.
Yes.
Stuart, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. Kevin in Seattle. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, just to touch quickly on the missing soldiers, I find it a little bit suspicious that the White House is trying to distance itself from this or acting like they don't care that much.
Well, they know how the first Bush administration used the hostages in Iran to beat up Jimmy Carter. I mean, hostages really tug at people's heartstrings.
And in Iraq, in the first Iraq war, we had a guy, I believe, that went missing for a couple weeks. His plane crashed, if I'm recalling this correctly.
We have a guy who's been missing for 2 years in this war. There's been no coverage of him.
I just feel like maybe what they're actually hoping for is for this to sort of spring upon the public consciousness to rally our sympathies behind the effort against the bad guys. You know what I mean? I think that they really want this thing to get some traction.
I'm misunderstanding what you're saying. The White House doesn't want us talking about the two missing GIs, or you're saying that they do?
No, I think that they're only pretending they're not that concerned about them. I think they want this to grow and for us to be talking about them a whole bunch.
Oh, interesting.
I'm sorry, I'm talking about them now.
I respectfully disagree with you. I think that they know the potency of a hostage, that it has more power than even a dead person because people can identify with a hostage. But, you know, I might be wrong. I don't know. You may be right, Kevin. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Coming up tomorrow, Yaron Brook is going to be here. He's going to say, stop appeasing and start attacking Iran. I'll be challenging him, and we're going to be talking to the former Speaker of the Texas House, Ben Barnes. Should be interesting. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.